This is Patient Care Theory 2, Unit 1, Part 3B. Let me just raise this table a little bit here. Stand by. So let's talk about how to triage in a mass casualty situation. So there are different triage systems, methodologies in terms of how you categorize patients based on airway, breathing, and circulation. And this is just one of them. And so just have a look at it. This one works reasonably well. There are very few that are truly evidence-based when it comes to triaging, except for the jumpstart triage system for pediatric patients. This is the most common set of cards that you'll carry in the ambulance. By the way, this is the front and back. This is a single card. The front will have RX, and the back will have that number on it. Yeah.
Did you want to know if we did this already?
I think we did the last one.
We've been through that.
Have we been? Let's just double check. Are you sure we went through the assessment component where?
No.
We just. I gave you a bit of an orientation.
Okay.
Yeah. No. No. I appreciate you telling me that though, because it's not. It's not unusual for me to give the same talk twice until someone stops me. But I showed you the cards in the last presentation.
Okay.
Now I'm going to go over some of the details of how you determine whether someone's blue, red, yellow, or green. So just a quick refresher. So green means delayed, so there's no potential life threat. So, a broken forearm might have to wait 2-3 hours. And now, I'm not going to tell them that. We're going to try to get them off the scene sooner, much sooner. But the reality is, if someone can walk to an area where there are greens, if they have nothing life-threatening, then they're going to be in that category, even if they're in a lot of pain. If they have no pulse, in that arm or something, that's a different story. But if it's just a broken limb and it's not a femur, not something like a major bone, then it's not an issue. So yellow would be like our priority 3 call, not lights and sirens. It would be something more serious, but not life-threatening. So for example, if someone has a femur fracture, it's not badly angulated, we don't see a lot of swelling of the leg. Now when they get re-triaged, if the leg went from this width, 6-inch wide thigh to 12 inches, then we got some significant bleeding happening internally and the risk of compartment syndrome. So that might change when they get re-triaged. But other than that, most extremity fractures would end up a yellow or a second priority. So delayed definitive care, 2-3 hours, not anticipate to threaten their outcome, as an example. So if they're getting a yellow, then we would just tear off the green tab and leave them with the yellow tag. Or if, like Simcoe, you're using tapes or ribbons to wrap around the wrist or something, then we'd use that sort of a system instead of this kind of a system, which actually makes a lot more sense to me than this kind of a tag system. So the red is immediate priority, so this would be a threat to life. And so where they have a high probability of survival if they receive definitive care within 30 to 60 minutes. And so we tear off the bottom two tags, leaving just the red. And then the dead or the dying. This is a difficult one. If they're dead, it's not a biggie. But if they're dying, it's a little more challenging. Yeah?
Would red be also threat to limb?
So red would be threat to limb, yeah. So if you had to put a tourniquet on for an amputated limb, yeah, that would be an immediate life threat. That's not just a threat to limb, that's a threat to threat to life. Now, on the other hand, if you had a grossly angulated leg, you're probably not going to take the time to check for pedal pulses or posterior tibial pulses. You're just going to leave that as a yellow. But when you re-triage them, that's when you might bump them up to a 4, threat to limb. It's a different story. But it's a bit of a judgment call. Like if I see a leg that's, where a thigh is bent this way and then the tib fib is bent all the way around, without checking for a pedal pulse, if I see it, I probably have a good sense that they have compromised distal circulation, so I might put them in a red. And they might get re-triaged to a yellow later when someone comes along and straightens out the leg and, the color is restored in the foot, or they actually get the foot exposed and they can see the color in the foot. So a dying patient is a little bit difficult. So if you if they have a pulse and they're unresponsive and they're not able to maintain an open airway, they're not able to breathe spontaneously, despite being put in, say, a recumbent, semi-recumbent position, then we're going to leave them as blue, as dead or dying. And again, we'll re-triage, and we categorize them as quote-unquote expectant. So they can't get the, won't get the benefit for resuscitation unless we have adequate resources. But you got to be careful with resources, though, because if you're, if you got 40, 50 people on scene, and you know you've got, let's say, 10 paramedics, and now you've got another 8 firefighters, you know, you may not be able to do, the site coordinator may not be able to do the math quickly enough to determine, you know, whether these expectant patients can get any form of resuscitation. Yeah.
If their spouse was with them, willing to do the BVM, would you then put them?
Never. No, I would never let. I would never give any equipment to bystanders, family, or otherwise, except maybe a dressing, like a, to control bleeding, but definitely not a BVM. I mean, there's, in a triage situation, you got to remember there's just no time to instruct them, and I would never, ever, ever give a BVM to a bystander and instruct them how to do it. A firefighter, sure, I'll make sure they know how to do it and give them instructions if they're having difficulty, but not a bystander. Yeah.
If it's EMT off shift?
Like a paramedic off shift, you mean? When you say EMT, I think of the United States. So,
oh, okay.
So if someone identifies themselves as an EMT, I would probably send them to the yellow area. And you know, if they're an off-duty paramedic, I'd send them to the code 4 area. But yeah, you got to be careful with the way people identify themselves too, right? Where do you send nurses and doctors? What's that?
Red.
Yeah, to the red. Yeah, send them to the red. I'm not going to do an interview, you know. I'm not going to ask the nurse, where do you work? What's your training exactly? Because it just takes too long, right? And there's no point. So let's look at clinical criteria. So the first thing that you do when you're the first crew on scene, remember, is we shout out to everyone who can walk. Put yourself in a position where you want the ambulatory people. So don't stand here and shout for people to come to you if you think the ambulances are going to be coming in this direction where you are, right? Because that's what people do by mistake. Get over to an area that's sort of off to the side and where you can put those ambulatory people. And ideally you want to assign one person who's in that crowd who's a first aider to just stay with people and make sure they stay there. Like, take them aside, have a quick discussion with them and just say, can you keep people in this area? If you're, you know, do any first aid you need. If you need equipment, just next crew in, let them know. So they go under minor. The dead are usually code 5. But if they're code 5, clearly they go in the deceased category. But if they're dead and they're not code 5, they're going to go in the deceased category as well, because we don't have adequate resources to do resuscitation. And then there's that dying category that I talked about. You know. So criteria for deceased: if you open the airway and assess breathing, and they're breathing, they can go into immediate. If you open the airway and they don't breathe and they remain blue despite the airway being open, then they go to deceased, to dying, and that's as long as we don't have sufficient resources to initiate a resuscitation. And you got to be mindful of firefighters when they come in. Hopefully you won't get fired right after the first crew, because the first crew is going to be busy triaging. Next crew might take the role of a site coordinator, and the site coordinator needs to coordinate personnel, so they can't let fire into that scene. You know, fire would go to the different categories, or they might be told, move this patient over here and come back and see me, and they'll move this patient over there. You know, they might be doing that sort of thing. But the minute firefighters get loose in a triage situation, I'm telling you this only because from experience, they don't know what they're doing. This is not something they do. It's not their area of expertise. They will They will hunt around and look for the sickest patient and then start resuscitation. We don't want them doing that. We cannot allow them to do that because then the triage just goes to chaos, right? So we gotta be careful about that. So airway, if there's sufficient personnel to maintain the airway, then they get categorized as red. But in most cases they won't if it's a big MCI. So breathing. This is not the greatest rule. I'm not even a big fan of this whole respiratory rate criteria, but it's not totally unreasonable either. So if they're breathing at less than 10 or greater than 30, then they're categorized as red. We can retriage them later. You know, people get hurt, they're anxious about the situation, they're scared for themselves, they're scared for their relatives, and they breathe fast, right? But if we want to keep triage simple, if they're breathing at a rate greater than 30, they get categorized as red. If their rate is between 11 and 29, then we go on to assess circulation, and they'll likely, we'll see if they still require red. So when you move on to circulation, if radial pulse is not palpable and there's obvious hemorrhage, we're gonna deal with that with pressure dressings and tourniquets. I think on your slide it doesn't say tourniquet, so you just add tourniquet to that. But if the radial pulse is palpable, we treat for hemorrhage at present with dressings and assess, move on to level of consciousness. So here's the thing about pulses you may or may not have discussed in the lab, you probably have. There's old dogma that used to say if you've got a radial pulse, you've got a blood pressure of at least 80. Have you heard that?
Yeah.
Okay, it's total bullshit. Do you know that?
Yeah.
Okay, you know it's BS, right? Good. Did we talk about this last year? I think we did. Okay, so a palpable pulse means nothing. And a palpable radial pulse, carotid pulse, brachial pulse, doesn't matter. It doesn't tell you anything about the blood pressure. I had a guy who had a pressure of mid-40s. He had a palpable radial pulse. I think I told you about this guy last year. He drove his car to a parking lot in this park area and he cut his wrist. That didn't work, he didn't die that way. So he cut his other wrist and that didn't work. And then he cut his throat and he lost a lot of blood in his car. I don't think he hit a jugular vein, which is amazing, but he hit a lot of other veins. And his pressure was in the mid 40s systolic, but he still had a palpable radial pulse. So there's never been any evidence to support, no research, no evidence to support the notion that a palpable radial pulse is a blood pressure of at least 80 systolic and a palpable carotid pulse is a blood pressure of at least 60 systolic. So just know that it's crap, it's bullshit. But nonetheless, triage is not a perfect system. If a patient looks like 10 pounds of dirt in a 5-pound bag, you know, they look pale, they're bleeding, and you can't palpate a radial pulse, then we categorize them as a red. If the radial pulse is palpable, we treat for hemorrhage and move on to level of consciousness. So we have to keep it simple. Even if the evidence, you know, sort of contradicts some of this stuff, we gotta keep it simple. In terms of level of consciousness, so alert, they're gonna go to green. Alert but potentially life threat, they're gonna go to yellow. If they respond only to verbal with no life threats, they go to green. If they're confused, they go to yellow. So that's a good way of remembering it to me. They're awake, but they're confused, you know. Do you know where you are right now? Oh, I'm not sure. Okay, yellow, off they go to yellow, right? Unless we see, you know, a major bleed or something like that. If they respond only to pain, but no other potential life threatening that we're aware of, they go to a yellow. If they have a potential life threat, then they go to a red. And if they're unresponsive, completely unresponsive, they go to red. And unresponsive is basically they don't respond to either a trap squeeze or a sternal rub. We're not doing a Glasgow coma scale at this point. We're just doing an AVPU, right? So if they don't respond to whatever pain stimulus you give them, then they get a red. Does that make sense? And so in determining the category, if you got an airway issue, you want to position them to maintain their own airway. Nobody can stand there or sit there or kneel there and keep their airway open unless you've got adequate resources. And if you got adequate resources, you're no longer in a high critical triage situation, right? Apply dressings for hemorrhage control, move to the next casualty. Secondary triage is performed only after the casualties have been tagged, and then they get re-triaged and moved, or moved and then re-triaged. Patient conditions are reviewed, triage tag may be revised, but the cart should always remain with the patient and should be completed prior to the transfer of care to the hospital. This whole tag thing, I don't know that anyone uses this, and mass casualty incidents are so uncommon, I would be surprised if anyone remembered to deal with these corner tags that we have on the med tag system. And this is the tag system most ambulances have in the province, but not all of them. So when you start doing your rideouts, you want to take a look at whatever triage tags they're using, or triage ribbons, right? So the transporting crew would detach the ambulance corner for later documentation. So the idea is, you're not giving full reports to the hospital. You're going to the hospital, you might give an extremely brief report, less than 30 seconds, and then you get back in your ambulance and you return to the scene to get more patients. So it's a super, super quick turnaround, super, super quick cleanup. You gotta move quickly. You might even have to run for the first time in your paramedic career. I don't know what I told you, but the first time I ever ran in my entire paramedic career, I dislocated my left shoulder.
So, your shoulder?
Yeah. It was an old injury from gymnastics, and I was on this wharf, and it was at night, and coming off the wharf onto the sand, I didn't realize it was like a 1 foot drop, so I missed that step, and when I went down, I popped my shoulder out.
You did gymnastics.
I know, eh? It's hard to believe. Yeah. So I don't do any round-off back handsprings anymore, though. It's just no longer my repertoire. What's that?
Is there footage of this somewhere?
No, unfortunately. No, I wish there was. But I do have a photo of me walking on my hands in the school foyer in my gym shorts, if you want to see that. I'll see if I can find it for you, just so you can have a good laugh. You see my porn stash, right? The mustache I had when I first started my career?
Oh, no.
You've seen that? No, you haven't seen that? Okay. That's coming out later. Okay. So the hospital should get the other tag there, so we can figure out who transported what patient where at the end of all this. So the principles of triage is the same between PCP and ACP. ACP should not be triaging, but I've been to lots of multi-casualty incidents, relatively small scale, like 10, 15 patients, where we arrived on scene. I've been to a few anyway, where there was no triage done at all. And so we ended up triaging for the first time, and there were, you know, maybe two other paramedic crews on scene. But for the most part, if you're working with an ACP and you arrive on scene, you rely on the crew that's on the scene, the PCP who's on the scene. They should be doing the triage. ACP should not do that. It's a PCP skill. And ACP should go where they're told to go, just as doctors and nurses should go where they're told to go, right? Their job is not to triage. Their training is not in this kind of triage. Triaging in the emergency department is very, very different from triaging in the field. And doctors and nurses are needed where there are critically injured patients, not the triage part. If you're working with ACP, you're going to be looking after the most critical patient. And you're going to stick together. I think I told you this incident I went to. There were one car, eight people, several people tossed. At least four of them were critical, four or five of them were critical, two of them were serious. I don't think there were any real minor injuries there. And the triage officer said, "Rob, you guys are going to that lady there. She's sitting on a log." And we went to this lady. She was sitting on a log, and she had 10 out of 10 pain in her neck, and she couldn't move. And I'm there with her doing a quick assessment, and I look around, and my partner's gone. He's, like, gone. And I look, and then I see him over by the car. I said, I won't say his name, but I said, "Can you come back here?" "Oh, I'm just helping out the..." "No, now." So he came back, and we assessed her. We were the first we were the last crew on the scene to arrive on the scene. We were the first crew to leave. And that's usually the way it should be. And you can't drift apart from each other unless you're the first crew on scene and you're both triaging and you both decided, you know, I'm going to take this half, you take that half, or I'll take this third, you take that third, next crew arrives, we'll assign that last third. You know, that's the way it works. But if you're going to be a transport crew, you're not going to be doing any triage or site coordinating, or you're not going to be the scene commander, then you stay with your partner and you go where you're told to go. And that was just one instance where I was really ticked at my partner because he was, that's the kind of guy he was. But I've been to a few others where my partner's drifted away and, you know, I've had to reel them back, get back here, you know, buddy. And in an ideal world, you might have this kind of setup. So if you had a big train crash, you might have this kind of setup, but it rarely works this well, where you've got, you know, this incident command post, and you've got a green area and a blue tag area and a yellow tag area and a red tag area, and you've figured out the staging areas where ambulances are going to make their access and egress. You got to figure this out, but it's never going to look pretty like that. And everything changes depending on the type of scene it is as well. So if it's a fire or chemical spill, then fire would be the main site coordinator, and ambulance would be, or paramedic would be off to the side. If it's a multiple shooting, then there's going to be a police commander, and ambulance and fire are going to be off to the side. So if it's largely a medical incident, so if it's a passenger train crash, the paramedic chief will be in charge. If it's a chemical train crash, the fire chief will be in charge, if it's or the deputy chief. And if it's a crime scene, the police will be in charge. It's just kind of the way it works for incident command. And the rest of us are just minions, and we do what we're told. It's difficult for paramedics to do that because you'll spend years, just you and your partner, in charge of everything. Nobody tells you what to do. Nobody tells you how to do things. You make all the decisions yourself, and now suddenly you're in a position where you've got to take orders. You have to take orders. There's no, otherwise everything goes to chaos. And when it comes to debriefing, you know, if I was out of line and started wandering off, or I shouldn't have wandered off, I'm going to hear about it from my chief. And it's like a tactical incident. If you become a tactical medic, your life is no longer your own. You've lost all your independence. You're going to follow orders. If you don't follow orders, officers are going to get killed, paramedics are going to get killed. And the scene's going to be absolute chaos, right? So you have to be a... There are lots of medics who have applied to become tactical medics and didn't make it through the screening process, the psychometric testing, because they didn't have the personality for following orders. You know, they were too independent-minded, and so it happens. So that's, a beautiful picture of what it would look like in the ideal world. Everyone's lying supine. They've all got their hands at their side. There are no angulated bones. There's no blood, you know. It's a perfect situation. So second, third, fourth vehicles responding while en route, you'll get the following information. So you're gonna be updated as to potential hazards, location of the staging area. So staging area means where you're going to park until you're told to come in, right? Just like staging at a crime scene, if you get a call that there's a shooting and police are asking you to stage through your dispatch center, then you're going to, staging means you're going to park a block, two blocks away where the people with the guns and the knives can't see you. And you're going to roll your windows up and lock your doors because the bad guys, if they come running around the block and they see an ambulance, they're gonna try to hop in there and do a carjacking with your ambulance and get you to drive away using your lights and sirens. So keep your doors locked in a staging area for a crime scene. Here, you probably don't have to worry too much about locking your doors, but just be aware it's a chaotic situation. So upon arrival, you notify CAC of your scene arrival. And in a situation where the helicopter is going to be landing or likely to be landing, and you'll hear about that probably on the way to the scene, they only need maybe one vehicle with the lights flashing at the scene. When you arrive on the scene, I would just put your four-ways on, put your hazard lights on, and keep your lights off, because the flashing lights are blinding to the pilots as they're coming in for final approach. And when I worked on the helicopter, the pilots quite frequently called us to the back and said, can you call your dispatch and ask them to shut off the lights on all the vehicles? And so we'll do that. One vehicle is probably fine. Turn off emergency lights and keep radio repeater systems off, because the first vehicle on scene will have its repeater system on, and you don't want multiple vehicles with repeater systems on, because what happens is if you forget to turn off your repeater system and you leave the scene, someone with a portable at the scene may be trying to call dispatch, and their portable radio is linked to your repeater as you're driving away, so that creates a communication problem. So we turn the repeater systems off. You want to wear the appropriate personal protective equipment, report to the site coordinator or traffic control officer, whoever that happens to be. So the key points for triage is the number of patients exceed the number of available resources, and acuity is not something we measure in degrees. It's measured in very simple, finite terms, in terms of airway, breathing, and circulation. But it is a dynamic process, and mistakes will be made. And that's why we triage, move people, re-triage, so on and so forth, as conditions change, or as reassessment warrants, or as resources become available. As I mentioned, there's no current civilian MCI triage system that's validated by outcome data. However, the Center for Disease Control likes the START system. And the START system is really more of a triage tag than a triage methodology per se. So just remember, it's a dynamic and not a static process. Any questions about triaging? I think what I'll try to do is, I haven't done this before because I usually do it in the lab, but I think I'm going to try to develop maybe a tabletop exercise where we try to sort people out. I think it might be a fun activity. I'll do it at the desks. Any questions about triage? No? Okay.